the farm. You were quite young when you went on one of those buses.
Yes, I was. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I went to high school from 1964 to 1968. We lived in the East Bay in the suburbs south of Oakland until I was partway through high school. And then we moved to San Francisco, started going to high school in San Francisco. During that time that I was in high school, I was in a rock and roll band. I played an electric guitar, and I was very much involved in that. We started doing that in 1965. We went to see the Rolling Stones, and we saw the Beatles. I went to a Beatle concert, and we saw all these bands. But then, in 1966, that was when the Fillmore Auditorium and the Avalon Ballroom started having this incredible music renaissance right there in San Francisco. Now, the thing about those places was they did not serve alcohol. They didn't serve beer, wine, or anything like that, which meant that there was no age restriction for going. In America, if it's a bar, you have to be 21. And so my parents let us go. We wanted to see these great musicians, and we were not really using drugs or anything. We were just teenagers. But we started going. The first time I went to the Fillmore Auditorium, I was 15. You know, I was very young. And so then when I was in high school, I moved to where I could walk from my house to Golden Gate Park. I could walk to the Haight-Ashbury district from where I lived. And this whole countercultural revolution was happening. And I felt that because I was going to these concerts and I was trying to play this music, that I felt like I was kind of part of it. But in 1968, by then, the Vietnam War had been going on a very long time, and it was very divisive. And the civil rights movement was happening, and all these movements were taking place. You know, it was like Black Power. The women's movement was starting, and the environmental movement, and the gay rights. And my parents were progressive politically, and so I was raised more on the left side of the political spectrum. So I was already had compatible views, and you know, my parents also they were big jazz fans, and they liked art. And so when I was a kid, I was very aware of the beatniks and, you know, the beat movement that was happening. And my parents loved to party with their friends, and they liked to make live jazz music, and they loved poetry and all this stuff. They were not countercultural people by any means, but they enjoyed all that. And so I grew up being aware of all this, and I was in the rock and roll world and jazz and music and all this. And so suddenly, here's this countercultural revolution taking place right there, right in front of me. And at the same time, there was this tremendous political divisiveness. I graduated from high school in June of 1968. 2 months before I graduated from high school, Martin Luther King was assassinated. A third of my high school was black. So this was like a bomb hitting everybody. And then 3 days before I graduated from high school, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. And my father was a politician. He was the chairman of the Democratic Party in California when I was 14 and 15 years old. I had met Robert Kennedy. It was this time of conflict and upheaval and change. My parents wanted me to go to college, and I didn't really want to go. I wanted to play rock and roll. I wanted to be part of this change in some form. I didn't really know. And then as time went on, I drifted more and more into it. I graduated from high school. I moved out of my parents' house when I was a couple of months past my 18th birthday. And increasingly, I fell in with this tribe of people that banded together and ultimately went on the road and founded a community. I just was drawn to these people. The farm was really started around this one guy. This was a time of gurus, the Maharishi and all of these teachers and gurus and Indian religion and Zen and all manner of religion people were incorporating in one way or another. And in America at that time, it wasn't just Eastern religion. The Jesus movement, the fundamentalist Christians grew in numbers enormously at that same time. It was a time of spiritual awakening all over the world, in Europe too. And there was a lot of experimenting with psychedelic drugs.
How much did the drugs play a role?
Oh, it played a big role.
In which way? For a community or for...
I would say what LSD does is it makes you conscious of the fact that even though we are these human bodies made up of matter, that if you go deeper and deeper into the more microscopic world, if you go far enough, it's really energy moving around, and everything's moving, and everything's energy. I think what LSD does, if you're lucky, is it will drive that home to you. It will make you not think, oh, intellectually, I get that. No, you will experience it. And that might be fun for you. It might be terrifying. It depends on a whole lot of things. But if you have that experience, you're not likely to come out the other side of it being exactly the same as you were before. I, just a kid who was kind of up for experimenting, and I went out camping with my friends one time, and we all took these pills. And then I was up in these hills. It was like farmland, and I could see really far distances, and I could see that the earth curved. And so I was having this experience that my body was energy, but at the same time, I'm looking at the earth, at Mother Earth. You know, suddenly it all was connected to me in a way. I wasn't, as growing up, I wasn't really that interested in nature, particularly. Didn't camp, didn't hike, didn't really care. I was interested in rock and roll and being in the city. And suddenly I saw the power of nature in a way that I never had before. It just changed me. Like, I want to learn more about this. One of the beautiful things about San Francisco is that right on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge, there is all this open land. And there's Mount Tamalpais up there, beautiful, magical mountain. So I would go up there and try to explore my inner self. At the same time, I was engaged in nature in pure form. I was having these great experiences. Meanwhile, this was in 1969, these friends of mine, one night, they came over to my house and they said, come on, we're going to this meeting. You got to see this guy. And we went over to Haight Street to this theater that used to be there where all the seats were ripped out. So it was like a little meeting hall. It was really dark in there. And so we were all sitting down, and then this guy starts talking, and he's done this stream of consciousness where he's talking about religion and morals and ethics and history and culture and politics and consciousness and the whole process of tripping and going up and down and relationships, you know, all that. He's just talking all this stuff. And I could hardly understand what he was talking about. It didn't really make much sense to me, but it was interesting. And there were certainly people there that I knew. It turned out that a bunch of the people I went to high school with were already going to these meetings. And so I went a few times, but I didn't really understand it. And so then I stopped. Friend of mine and I hitchhiked around the country. Right after my 18th birthday, I was involved in a really infamous murder trial in San Francisco. This off-duty white policeman shot and killed a black man in an argument without identifying himself as a policeman. And so it was a huge controversy. And a friend of mine, the guy I hitchhiked with, had witnessed this murder. And the reason I was in it was because I was at his house the next day after the murder, and the cops raided our apartment for no good reason I could exactly tell. But then when the trial came, the attorneys trying to get the white cop declared innocent wanted to discredit my friend's testimony by depicting him as a violent student radical who hated the police. And the reason they knew this was because they had come to the apartment the next night, and they described his apartment as having written on the walls, "Kill the pigs," and "Revolution," and "Black power." And they didn't even say that I was there. And so the reason I was in this trial was to get on the stand and say that all the cops were lying, which they were. We told the truth, they lied, but they prevailed. They got the guy off. We were completely discredited. This is important for me because my faith in the American justice system pretty much went down the tubes at that time. And I was like, so that's how it works, huh? That sent me toward the counterculture a lot faster. Meanwhile, Vietnam's going on, and I don't want to go there. I don't want to be part of that. And so I just opted to go as far the other end as I could. I grew my hair long. I started hitchhiking around, camping in the hills. And then in the course of all this, I was up on Mount Tam one day, just having one of those kind of meditations where it all comes together. So I'm sitting there thinking absolutely nothing. And then this phrase came up, no mind. And I went, no mind. It's like a Zen phrase. Where did I hear that? Oh, yeah. I heard it from this guy at that meeting. Maybe I'll go back there, see what that's about. Made sense suddenly. So I started going back. And because of the experiences I had had, the things he was saying now made sense to me. And I thought, I like this. And I like these people. And so I just started going regularly, and I started getting to know those people. And when he got invited to go on this speaking tour around the country, he was already living in a bus, I wanted to go. I wanted to be part of it. I didn't live on a bus. I didn't have anything, but, you know, there was like 200 people that wanted to go with him. A bunch of them were already living in buses, but there were 70 of us who did not have the means by ourselves, or we weren't connected to a family. And we would meet on Sunday mornings at this park. And he said, you know, anybody who wants to go but doesn't have the means, you guys meet, work it out. You show up at this time in this place when it's time for us to go, and you have it together, you can go too. So I did. I started hanging out with this group, getting to know them and getting to meet these people and talking and working it out and whatnot. And so after about a month of having these weekly meetings, and then it got to be kind of every day, it was time to band together for real. And so this guy takes his jacket, puts it on the ground, spreads it out under this tree, and everybody lines up. Okay, we're going to throw in. Now it's time. And we all lined up, and whatever money anybody had, they would put it in. And I had, I think, $40 in a backpack. And so one by one, we just put this money on this jacket again and again, and it got to be a pretty big pile. And so when we were all done, there was $9,000 there, which was a lot of money in 1970. So from that moment, it was a crossing over. That was the beginning of living collectively. First day, we took this money and we said, okay, we're going to entrust it to this guy. We're going to meet back here the next day. And then this other group's going to go to this place over in the East Bay that sells buses and buy a couple. And they did. They came and they bought two buses, and they were school buses with all the seats in them. And it's like, okay, we got to get rid of these seats. And so we went to a park that just in the parking lot of a public park that wasn't really particularly being used. And we just took a bunch of wrenches into these buses and unbolted all the seats, took them out and put them in a huge pile in the parking lot. And then when they were all out of both buses, we stuffed them all into one of the buses and took it off to the dump and got rid of the seats, came back, and then we had two empty buses and 70 people. And so, okay, now it's nighttime. We're going to divvy up into 35 people each, and we're going to drive these buses out to the beach, and we're going to sleep in them. And then the next day, we went out and bought another bus, and then the next day, another one and another one. And so pretty soon, when we used up all our money, we bought 9 different buses, and we divvied ourselves up into these by groups, and it was very informal. Some people sort of knew each other, but a lot of us really didn't. And then suddenly it's like, okay, I'm going to go with this group, and I'm going to go in this bus, and whatever happens, that's going to be my little bus family.